Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 73 at the very beginning, which is old single column, page 821. Okay, big transition. And we finally wrapped up that block of papers, the civilization papers. We're now into a rather lengthy block of papers on Adam and Eve. And, not just Adam and Eve immediately, but all of the consequences of Adam and Eve being here, both biologically and culturally, going forward. And eventually fleshing out the rest of the timeline. Remember, we started back a trillion years ago. The rest of the timeline from where we left off up to the beginning of recorded history. And hence giving most of the explanation for the mysteries that exist at the beginning of recorded history. Number of things that seem to just appear out of nowhere and on the first page of recorded history. Things like the Sumerians, for instance. Not to mention a lot of very mysterious megalithic artifacts and stuff like that. Okay? But obviously, first things first, we need to deal with Adam and Eve directly. And they before they get to the individuals, they set the stage. How it is that there came to be a Garden of Eden that Adam and Eve could step into when they were transported here. Remember how way back we read about the material sons and daughters in general and the whole dematerialization, rematerialization process and the mysteries of that. As close as you get to kind of the literalness of the transporter in Star Trek, if you will. What actually happens is they're given a Marantia expression that can be transported, and then they're brought back to a material expression. If that clears up anything, it's still pretty deeply mysterious, right? But nonetheless. Remember, when last we left this story, we basically had Van and Amidon holding down the fort, starting 200,000 years ago, and going forward all by their lonesome. Well, there was, we saw that there's some other celestials that they're part of a group, Melchizedek receivers and whatnot. But in terms of something that the humans on the planet can see, they appear to be all alone in this effort to try to hold things together some. They become part of that sort of emergency situation where you're trying to hold things together enough that when the next dispensational sun comes along, right, there's something to come to. Right? Uplifters can't uplift nothing. Right? It's not a magical enterprise. It's got to be a minimal something for them to engage in uplift. So just like Machaventa did to try to prepare the way for the Creator Son to be incarnate here as a bestowal son, this whole crew is trying to hold things together some, but they have limited authority, even, let alone power, to push forward very much. They'd be imposing their personal flavor, their will upon the situation, and that's, there's limits there. Everyone knows that it seems like some eternal catastrophe when there's a rebellion, say. But in the scheme of the evolutionary process, this is all just part of the process. You can't make the supreme being eventually, without lots of iniquity, even iniquity on a big scale. You know, it's the only way to get that end. Like we often are reminded, the only way to make one of those very, very talented supreme adjusters is that he has to have ridden an individual down to iniquity, at least one. You know, and they may have ridden many. It's the only way to make a supreme adjuster is through individual iniquity like that. So, it may seem like that individual went to nothing, but not really, right? They were a means to an end, and the only means to that particular end, like I was just saying. So, this hodgepodge planetary government that's going on here knows that you respect the evolutionary process. No matter how negative the actual, it's just as infinite a positive potential. Yeah, no matter how negative the finite actual is, right? It's always an infinite positive potential. And even if none of those involved can see it, right? Have the insight to penetrate that deeply. They know, even, not only without sight, but even without insight, that it exists. And they trust that. They just let it play out. Okay. I think that's probably about all we need. Why don't we jump in and give it a shot?
All right. Paper 73, The Garden of Eden. The cultural decadence and spiritual poverty resulting from the Caligastia downfall and consequent social confusion had little effect on the physical or biologic status of the Urantia peoples. Organic evolution proceeded apace, quite regardless of the cultural and moral setbacks which so swiftly followed the disaffection of Caligastia and Dalagastia. And there came a time in the planetary history, almost 40,000 years ago, when the life carriers on duty took note that, from a purely biological standpoint, the developmental progress of the Urantia races was nearing its apex. The Melchizedek receivers, concurring in this opinion, readily agreed to join the life carriers in a petition to the Most Highs of Edentia, asking that Urantia be inspected with a view to authorizing the dispatch of biologic uplifters, a material son and daughter.
Okay, so notice between the lines there, one of the things they're doing is kind of getting you synced up with the timeline they've laid out. Notice again our synchronization with the Ice Age. As you might recall, they tell us that 35,000 years ago was basically the end of the Ice Age. Specifically the end of the last wave of the Ice Age. So, 40,000 years ago, so you're having the biology, as an evolutionary ascending phenomenon, reaching its bottom-up limit, and is now ripe, it's plateaued, and the only way for it to go higher is for something to be brought down from above to uplift it beyond that evolutionary apex. And all that is happening just as the climate, is becoming more temperate and can allow, at the very minimum, for, a very pleasant region where there can be a garden. But then in general, in short order, Adam and Eve are going to be working on advancing the scientific culture of these people and stuff. And I mean, it can't be, 2/3 of the globe can't be a frozen wasteland, right, or something. So things are just delightfully synchronized again, because as we talked about so much back there in the biologic evolution papers, we often say, social evolution, biologic evolution, but really there's just evolution. It's all one system, right? The parts aren't disjoint, right? They're all synchronized elements within one evolving system. So there's an innate providence in the system, right? An innate wholeness in the system. It can't do anything but work together in these delightfully synchronized ways. No matter how separated, you know, it might seem to us, you know, that the biologic evolution would be tied to, you know, glacial evolution, geologic evolution. And it is. I mean, not to mention, coincidentally, there's a place on the planet that's just so to be a garden, right? And it all comes together. So, you know, you want to just remind yourself of that when, at times when you feel like you're an island universe of loneliness, you know, apart from everything. No, there is no such state. It doesn't exist. The only way to not be part of the system is to not exist. If you exist, you're part of a system. All right, let's see. Anything else there? Might want to even, anything kind of initial thoughts strike anyone that, you know, you're wondering about? You know, you notice how they said organic evolution proceeded apace quite regardless of the cultural and moral setback. You know, it does say, though, before that, you had the cultural decadence and spiritual poverty resulting from the Kalagasya downfall and consequent social confusion had little effect on the physical or biologic status of the Urantia peoples. You know, obviously, there's going to be some impact, you know, in the chaos. You might end up with, unfortunately, some of the better biologic strains dying in the, you know, in the warring chaos. Right? I mean, there can, you know, there's going to be some impact. But, you know, but that, you know, but the literalness of you know, all of the organisms under that evolutionary influence and going higher and higher to their apex, I mean, that doesn't change. You know, exactly what's there, you know, when all is said and done, okay, it could have been some better genetics. But again, in supremacy, there are no coincidences. It's not somehow wrong that the people who died. No matter how much even this planetary administrators, you know, feel, oh man, that is really unfortunate that we lost that strain. Well, in the eyes of the Supreme, no, it's all going to be exactly what it needs to be in the end.
Well, what jumped out at me is cultural decadence. It's one of the issues that I do think about a lot. I really love culture. It's one of the things that has gone down the tubes so much right now.
Yeah, and yes, and that, you know, the fact that struck you, just, you know, the fact that you resonate with that term is why the book is here, right? That's an emergency situation that you can read a sentence like that and go, wow, that reminds me of today. That's not supposed to be the case. Right? So, all right, we're slipping back. You know, it won't take much, and we'll be back to what it was like right in the wake of the rebellion, right? We could basically unravel everything that's slowly worked its way forward over the last 200,000 years, and we'd be right in that state again. It's all very tenuous. That biologic uplift, you know, is of such limited extent because of the default that, you know, unfortunate exercising of the will, now that we can exercise more will, we have a little bit more spiritual nature. I mean, you can effectively negate all of that biologic quality that you could be leveraging off of. You know, you can use your free will to do something unnatural in either a positive or a negative way. You can take what little you have and improve upon it, or you can take what little you have and erase it effectively. It's in your free will hands. So, anyway, so you've got that element. Let's see, I think that's, we got everything else, didn't we? Just maybe the one little thing. We always see it. There's always this protocol. Exactly. You know where I was going. Yeah. Right. You know, what we immediately want to call bureaucracy, right? Right, you know, there's always, you know, there's all these I's that have to be dotted and T's that have to be crossed. Everyone has to get in and, you know, put their stamp of approval on it. You know, so it's a, you know, it's just always there, everything we do. Whenever they talk about the doings on high, it's always there. Things are in triplicate and whatnot, you know. Right. Okay, keep on.
Okay. This request was addressed to the Most Highs of Edentia because they had exercised direct jurisdiction over many of Urantia's affairs ever since Caligastia's downfall and the temporary vacation of authority on Gerizim.
Yeah, you know, even though that temporary vacation, you know, was just a couple years, a couple Gerizim years, you know, like they mentioned, you may recall, I mean, there's a lot of things that still haven't been returned to Lanaforge. Most High still, you know, hold some items. You know, and that won't change until you have all of the fallen worlds, you know, in some, you know, fundamentally sort of revivified state, if you will. You know, you've got planetary princes on every world and things are rolling forward again.
Yeah, we just learned about one last couple of weeks that doesn't even have a magisterial son.
Right.
So
yeah.
A lot of ways to go, I would imagine.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the fact that that world did, you know, didn't get the special missiles unlike we did, and maybe since the book was written, maybe the magisterial son came, but at least at the time of writing, it didn't have it, and you know, you didn't get any sense from what we were reading there that. That there's been any sort of special thing that's, you know, helping them out. They're kind of just in this no planetary prince, no Adam and Eve, almost no nothing sort of state. And yeah, so the Most Highs need to, you know, still be doing their micromanaging of ruling in the kingdoms of men, you know, in a very kind of in. You know, inserting themselves right into the process in a very, you know, often very authoritative way, right? To make sure that the fundamental potentials aren't fundamentally disrupted. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's see, you've got that. Okay, what else do they give us here?
Okay, Tabamantia. Sovereign supervisor of the series of decimal or experimental worlds, came to inspect the planet and, after his survey of racial progress, duly recommended that Urantia be granted material sons. In a little less than 100 years from the time of this inspection, Adam and Eve, a material son and daughter of the local system, arrived and began the difficult task of attempting to untangle the confused affairs of a planet retarded by rebellion and resting under the ban of spiritual isolation.
Okay, a couple little points there. Does anyone remember what kind of a being Tabamantia is? No. Tabamantia is a finaliter.
Oh, that's right.
And a very special finaliter, right? An Agendonter finaliter. Not only an Agendonter finaliter, but an Agendonter that came out of the very first system rebellion in the universe of universes, right? All seven super universes had the very first system. We don't know if it's the very first world, but it is clear from them when they tell you that. It is definitely the very first system rebellion in the entire universe of universes. He was there, you know, got himself through that as an Agendonter, got all the way to Isle of Paradise, inducted in the Core of Finality, and he's now out as Sovereign Supervisor. Okay? Michael doesn't have say. He does. Right? See, one day you'll be a Finaliter, and you'll be Sovereign instead of the God of that domain. You won't be a god, but you'll be taking very high levels of you know, taking on very high levels of trust, right, and authority. You know, we often chuckle about getting to Uversa and having the ancients of days. Finally, you made it. You know, here. You know, and now I don't have to do this job anymore. Hand it off to you. You're like, me? Right, and that's, you know, that's a literal me, Lord, right? Here you see a very definitive example of that. Right?
This is his first assignment, comes out to...
We don't know. I mean, you know, think about it. This is the first system of rebellion. I mean, this, yeah, he could have done a lot of things in trillions and trillions and trillions of years, right?
Might not have even been at our ship.
Well, and it's
yeah, most likely not, yeah.
It's interesting. It's not that he's the sovereign supervisor of rebellious planets. He's the sovereign supervisor of experimental
worlds. Right, the entire series of experimental worlds in the whole local universe, right? All of them. Right?
That's impressive.
Yeah, and, you know, so in that...
So about a million of them.
Yeah, a lot of them, right, yeah. And in that context... I mean, the fact that there's a handful of them that are rebellion worlds, you know, I mean, whatever. I mean, that's in the noise of his level of, you know, supervision.
So he's on the road a lot.
Yeah. Fortunately, you know, as a finality like that, you can travel very fast. So, all by yourself. No transport angel needed, right? You can transport yourself from point A to point B. Do you remember why you can? It's because you have a relationship to the Supreme, right? You know, you're kind of the whole in a literal embodiment way instead of so much of a part, you know, and then needing someone who kind of has the big picture internalized, you know, to move you about. Right? You have the big picture internalized and you can navigate relative to it. So, you know, that whole bit of, you know, pledging your oath to the Trinity, right, to the whole,
yeah.
Right, going out, you know, revealing God the Mother, right, that stems from the Trinity, right, the whole, the individuality of the whole, so you embody that.
Do they talk about the velocity prerogatives?
No, they don't, but one would assume that it's, you know, at least like, you know, the Trinity beings, you know, like, say, divine counselors, stuff like that, you know. You know, may not be at solitary messengers, right. You know, levels, but, you know, it's, you know,
suffice.
many, you know.
Many times.
Yeah. Right. Maybe it's not, you know, 4 million times the speed of light, you know, 700,000 times the speed of light. Yeah, so you can get around. Yeah, especially if you're, you know, all you need to do is get around a local universe. Yeah. I mean, all you have to do is blink and you're from one side to the other, okay? So... No sweat. yeah, so that's Tappamatcha. Pretty cool stuff to think about how one day you'll be in that mode. Who knows what job you might have. Let's see. There was a couple other things there I wanted to get myself. Two other little things. So in a little less than 100 years... And when you first read that, you're not suspicious, but you see in a little bit, we'll come across this again, a little less than 100 years, and you're going, okay, I'm a little suspicious now. Do you suppose it's, remember, 100 of our years, or 100 Gerasim years is about 81 of our years. Do you suppose that there's something that's synchronized to a Gerasim century here? So that it ends up being, you know, a little less than 100, like maybe 81, you know, or thereabouts. You can't be, you know, help but being a little suspicious about that. Just to remind you of that little fact you've probably forgotten. But, you know, remember when they tell you it's 2 years on Gerasim, I mean, that's, you know, basically 2 years here too. So that's why the 7 years, you know, of resolving things here is 2 years resolving it on Gerasim and then 5 years transit time for the Melchizedek receivers, right? So that Gerasim is probably 15 light years away from us. So So that, I'll just give you a little heads up on that. And like I said, we'll see it again here in a little bit. And then the other thing, the very end there, resting under the ban of spiritual isolation. You know, pause for a second and remind ourselves of that mystery. You know, by that they don't mean that somehow beings on this, humans on this planet aren't encircled in the Holy Spirit. You know, that we're not talking about ubiquitous spirit presence, right? You can't carve a hole in a ubiquitous presence. There's no, right? There's no cutting you off from the presence of the Creator Mother Spirit. But these, you know, linearly, you know, spirit circuits, like the physical circuits of the master physical controllers, right? That's a big mystery in the book. They never give us any details about that. They never reveal any details about the beings that control that. They disclose their existence, these spirit controllers. But, you know, see, we don't know what's going on.
Yeah. Is there one tidbit about the message about the rebellion being caught up somewhere?
That's in those communication circuits, okay? I mean, you know.
Relay.
Yeah, right. But, you know, here we're, you know, we're not thinking of, you know, those communication lines. You lay out a line of physical energy and you lay out a line of spiritual energy and you have a line of mind energy between the two plates of it, if you will. You know, and you're communicating through that mind energy. And they cut those off by taking away the spirit line. Okay, and then so there can't be a mind line. There's just a physical line. Okay, obviously they could be using that spirit line for a number of things, or there could be just plain spirit lines. You know, they don't give us anything. We can only guess. But we know this having those circuits, those actual lines of spirit energy taken away, means, for instance, that even if you're a full-on first circler, from the time of the rebellion 200,000 years ago, until Pentecost, 2,000 years ago, no one could go on as an individual to the mansion worlds. Right? You had to be part of a group resurrection. And there's some unrevealed physics to that. It's not that, you know, they're just not doing it. You know? You can't be an individual ascender, you know, and you're just left wondering, well, why? You know, what's up with that? But, you know, they definitely tell you that once things are reestablished to some degree in the wake of our Creator Son becoming a Master Son, you know, not only did you get the Spirit of Truth, but you got some other things tweaked, okay? And we don't know what, you know, but... we aren't as spiritually isolated as we were, you know, up until Pentecost. But Adam and Eve are coming into this very minimally circuited space. And cut off from, you know, another thing that's involved in that, I mean, these spirit, you know, lines of energy and whatever they do and stuff are involved in all kinds of the ability for various celestial beings that are normally on worlds to do what they do, to help the planetary government. I mean, none of that can happen without this. And so they're very alone, you know, and, you know, we quickly see when we start reading about them the consequences of that.
Because also, spirit is also the source of value. If you're used to being with a more...
Well, now in that, see, you the humans have access to value because of their encirclement of the Holy Spirit. Yeah, and she's just the way I always try to precisely say that. You are encircled in the Holy Spirit. We're talking about things that are encircled in, like the planet or a being on the planet, right? Like the way the adjutants are encircled into you. You aren't encircled into it, right? It's all that, you know, you've got, you know, just someone's running across the universe with this spirit energy, you know, extension cord and plugging it into something on the planet, right? They pulled all the extension cords back, you know, and they still leave us, you know, with the mystery of all what's all that about, the physics of all that.
More Christmas.
their use of language is curious. Resting under the ban of spiritual isolation.
Mm-hmm.
It's like without that spirit energy, it's like there's things are knocked off. It's like,
yeah, I mean, there's a, you know, there's a darkness that descended, you know, that presses down on the world, if you will, right? You know, but, you know, don't, like I said, don't take that to, you know, the nth degree, right? I mean, for us as humans, just living on the planet, the Holy Spirit is plenty adequate. The civilization won't be advancing as rapidly because of this stuff. Like I pointed out, you wouldn't have been able to take, you know, be taken to the first mansion world as an individual ascender right away. I mean, okay, but just in terms of your mortal life, you know, and you know your efforts as an individual to achieve some degree of self-mastery, you don't need this stuff. And that, you know, kind of, you know, if you think that through like that, you can understand a little bit about why they don't reveal much of anything about all this stuff. Because it's not immediately tied to your ascension. Okay? The one element that is tied to your ascension, at least it was until 2,000 years ago, they do mention that. But all the other stuff, you know, that's about the evolution of a world, you know, towards light and life, you know, they don't tell anything about that because it's not just, you know, it's not about your ascension. Anyway, not to belabor that, but that's, you know, I just wanted to remind you in just simple little things in passing like that, they're getting you to think in these non-magical terms about the details of the cosmos, right? They're, you know, we have to try to purge ourselves of all the filling the blanks with magic that humans have always done. That's the whole point of the fifth epical revelation. You know, to give you a logical structure so that there isn't any need for magic, because there isn't any magic. Right? That's why there isn't any magic, because there's no need for it. Right? It's all taken care of in a direct causal physics. Be that material physics, mindal physics, spirit physics, deity physics, whatever physics it is, right? There's no magic.
Spoken like a true physics PhD.
Yeah. Well, and that's just, you know, remember I use that term because I'm reminding you of what the literalness of the word physics is. You know, it means the nature of. Right? Instead of saying the nature of God, if you want to kind of emphasize the precise technical facts of it, you could say it's the physics of God. That's all the word physics means is nature, right? You know, it's very important to kind of take little sides every once in a while and just make sure you're challenging yourself to not be in that old wineskin that humans have always been in. You know, you know you are in it. That magic, that domain where there's all kinds of stuff that's rationalized via magic. And what degree to which humans have gotten out of that a little bit, you know, I talk about all the time, we're falling back into it. Every place that was working really hard to eliminate magic as part of the answer, you know, the rationalization, is reverting back to it. Science is filled with magic filling in blanks now again. You know, and religion, of course, has always been hopeless about having magic filling in all kinds of blanks.
So would genetics be the chemistry then?
You know, in what sense? Wait, you're...
Would genetics be the chemistry then?
Oh. You're thinking about... Well, I mean, you know, I mean, in that sense, I mean,
maybe.
Chemistry is a specific part of the physics, right? I mean, you know, I mean, if you want to get, like, if you're thinking about atoms, you know, what's the difference of the physics of the atom and the chemistry of the atom? Well, I mean, in one sense, everything is the physics of the atom, but if you want to separate the two, where physics is one discipline and chemistry is another discipline, the chemistry is about the electrons of the atom and the physics is about the nucleus. Yeah. But I'm not using the word physics in that sense, you know, in the physics department at a university. I'm using it in that, you know, that etymological root sense. You know, the word is originally coined because there weren't all the, you know, it wasn't biology and, you know, chemistry and all this stuff. You know, I mean, it was all just physics. It was all just the attempt to figure out the details of nature. Okay. All right, so that's our little preface. So now, you know, they're going to pick up on the details where we left off. It's like, well, you know, what happened to the individuals involved, the humans and the superhumans of the rebellion? Oh, you got a question first?
I have a question about, Beth is asking a question about resurrection.
Uh-huh.
What about Enoch and Elijah? They fused before Pentecost.
Yep.
Why wouldn't they have resurrected?
Right, because, no, they resurrected. I mean, because, see, they don't, there isn't a soul that needs to be transported or anything. You know, and all the bit of, I mean, you fuse with your adjuster, right? The adjuster takes the soul there. The adjuster's transcendent of all these physics questions that we don't understand. Right, it's riding over the top of all that, if you will. Right?
Short circuit.
Right, just right, however you want to describe, analogize it. Yeah. Right, so, you know, that's why I said even if you were a first circle, I was purposely leaving off, right, going past first circle of diffusion.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you know, something that comes from paradise is going to be transcendent of any local issue, like spiritual isolation. You know, and once, you know, it gets you to the imagined worlds, right? I mean, everything is fine there, right? I mean, nothing is being curtailed there. That was only for a couple years. That was 200,000 years ago. So, right, if you can get there, right, and you're going, well, I mean, angels are still coming and going for all that time. See, again, we don't understand. They don't explain. But there's something about it, the, you know, the mysteries of the angel taking possession of your soul and somehow having this all synchronized with what happens on the first match. It's all very mysterious. I can't even remotely figure out why. But
maybe they should go through some kind of slow lane or something.
I mean, you know, see, it obviously can't be just the literalness of the, of, you know, being transported. There's something more deeply mysterious. I don't... You know, it's not like they aren't allowing transport seraphims to come and go. So, it's very mysterious. I don't know what it is. Anyway.
Section 1, the Nodites and the Amadonites.
Amadonites. Right, so you remember, the whole point is you have a name, like Amadon, and then you're just sticking ite on the end, yeah.
Amadonites. On a normal planet, the arrival of the material sun would ordinarily herald the approach of a great age of invention, material progress, and intellectual enlightenment. The post-Adamic era is the great scientific age of most worlds, but not so on Urantia. Though the planet was peopled by races physically fit, the tribes languished in the depths of savagery and moral stagnation.
And of course, I often remind everyone of that. You know, if Adam hadn't defaulted, if they could have somehow held it together... you know, after 25,000 years, in other words, 10,000 years ago, or not 10,000 BC, you know, we would have had full ultimatonic level physics, you know, would be controlling everything on the planet. I mean, right, that, like you're saying, that's their main job. You know, the great scientific age, age of invention, material progress, intellectual enlightenment. You go, oh, yeah, we didn't get the quote-unquote enlightenment until... Yeah, very recently, right? 17th, 18th, 19th century. Yeah. So it took us that long, you know, to even get some aspect of what would have happened very early on, you know, after Adam and Eve got settled in. Yeah. Okay.
10,000 years after the rebellion, practically all the gains of the prince's administration had been effaced. The races of the world were little better off than if this misguided son had never come to Urantia. Only among the Nodites and the Amadonites was there persistence of the traditions of Dalmatia and the culture of the planetary prince.
Yeah, they'll explain, you can see in the next paragraph, they're italicized. We'll get to the details of Nodites and Amadonites here in a second. But, remember, you know, we were just... That just came up. See, that's basically what we have the potential to drop back to, is what it was like about 10,000 years after the rebellion. Right? When it basically, you know, the tail of influence from the prince and his staff fades off and it's just at an evolutionary background level, that's what we can roll back down to, is that valley, right, of 190,000 years ago. All right, and a little better off than if this misguided son had never come to your ranch. You know, and I might point out, not to just emphasize the negative and try to get everyone fearful, but, you know, it actually technically could be much worse, because those people 190,000 years ago didn't have the potential to exercise their free will like we do. Right? We can potentially be self-destructive in a way they couldn't back then. Right? There's none so blind as those who will not see. Right? Here you're just talking about people who can't see. Right? So, again, you know, in a big, big picture sense, it wouldn't be an emergency if we just rolled back down to our natural state of 190,000 years ago. See, we wouldn't be like these people. We would be driving ourselves right through that bottom of that valley. Right? So, we've often talked about, you know, how many things were already in existence that are pre-primitive, which is unnatural. There is no such thing as natural pre-primitive. The very first humans are primitive. There is no such thing as pre-primitive humans naturally. The only way you can get that is with your using your personality to drive yourself pre-primitive. And I always point those things out when they say, you know, notice you have such and such in play, Ellen, the most primitive people a million years ago, you know, had better thoughts than that. Right? You can't get to a state like that except through the exercise of will. And they didn't get in those states a long time ago because, like I said, you couldn't be that personal way back then. I mean, like the Andonites especially, I mean, they were just like minimally personal. I mean, they didn't have enough foresight to put grandchildren and them together, right? They could get children, but they couldn't consciousize it. Grandchildren were too abstract. I mean, think about how limited that is. Right? How much willful harm can you do to yourself in that sort of a state?
Never three.
You can only, and you can't even make it to three. You get one, two, and you give up. Right? And just say many. Right? Right. Those people can't do a lot of willful harm to themselves. Right. So anyway, meanwhile, back to the regularly scheduled program. What do we have here? They're going to give us the details now about what do they mean by Noddites and Ammonites.
The Noddites mm-hmm. were the descendants of the rebel members of the prince's staff, their name deriving from their first leader, Nod, one-time chairman of the Dalmatia Commission on Industry and Trade. The Ammonites were the descendants of those Andonites who chose to remain loyal with Van and Amadon. Ammonite is more of a cultural and religious designation than a racial term. Racially considered, the Ammonites were essentially Andonites. Noddite is both a cultural and racial term, for the Noddites themselves constituted the eighth race of Urantia.
All right, so remember, you know, the Noddite thing, the rebels, you know, immediately were unplugged from being immortal, you know, being able to utilize the fruit of the tree of life to any effect. So Nod ordered them to immediately start, you know, procreating. And, you know, so you actually had those Andonite, initial Andonite genetic peoples of the prince's staff, but over 300,000 years, being plugged into the energies that they were, their genetics had morphed into a quality basically material son and daughter like. Right, so you have a quite sophisticated genetic people in the initial handful, but of course, you know, I mean, it's just a handful of people. So, you know, immediately they're blending in with the evolutionary stocks. But still, right, I mean, it's you know, it's worthy of indicating that genetic uplift of that eighth race. There were six Sangiks plus the Andonites. That's seven, so they make eight. But the Amidonites, the only member of the, remember there's the, you know, the core 100 staff, and then there's the parallel 200, I mean, the parallel 100, so that you have 200 total, that, you know, were also part of that whole staff system. And the only, you know, they were all, you know, taken off along with the loyal, you know, the loyal ones of those were taken off along with the loyal primary staff, you know, just leaving Van and Amidon, you know, still plugged in to the energies, you know, with the help of the Tree of Life. So there's no, you know, there's, and Van and Amidon are not engaging in sexual reproduction. It's just like none of this staff was originally, right? They're still, you know, maintaining that. So with the Amidonites, it's not like you have the descendants, you know, procreatively, right, of Amidon. You know, that's why they're saying, you know, Amidon is more of a cultural and religious designation. Now, the only reason that they have a little qualifier word, a fuzzy word in there, more of a, originally, right, it is just purely Andonite, but over the, you know, the millennia, some of the Nodites said, I've had enough of this bunch, this rebel bunch. I'm going to go up there with Van and Amidon. See, so you've got, you know, over time, you would get a little bit of higher genetic quality feeding into that group. Okay, but mostly you just have Andonites that are worthy of being called a different name of Amidonites because they have such an advanced cultural nature under the influence of Van and Amidon relative to the run-of-mill Andonites around the planet. All right, let's keep going.
There existed a traditional enmity between the Nodites and the Amidonites. This feud was constantly coming to the surface whenever the offspring of these two groups would try to engage in some common enterprise. Even later, in the affairs of Eden, it was exceedingly difficult for them to work together in peace.
Okay. You know, and you can even... Right, see, you know, shades of what results in the wake of the default. So, you know, it's already back there. There's this tension that was pre-existent to Adam and Eve, and what gets set up in the wake of them. You know, with in the wake of the default, and all that tension with the Nodites building up. Now, you know, we'll get to that eventually. If you aren't new to the book, you know what I'm referring to. But see, there's also this pre-existent tension between those that think that, well, you know, yeah, you have fancier culture, but mine is genetically based, right? And, you know, you're getting it secondhand. All right, there's this tension. I have genuine nobility, you know, you... You have faux nobility. So there's that tension that you know, Van and Amidon had to deal with all the time. Okay.
Shortly after the destruction of Dalmatia, mm-hmm. The followers of Nod became divided into three major groups. The central group remained in the immediate vicinity of their original home near the headwaters of the Persian Gulf. The eastern group migrated to the highland regions of Elam, just east of the Euphrates Valley. The western group was situated on the northeastern Syrian shores of the Mediterranean and in adjacent territory.
Okay, that's just a quick little note. I mean, they give you all those details when we get up to paper 77, I remember. Isn't that the paper number? The Midway Creatures paper. Yeah, paper 77. They'll go into detail about all those groups, including what I was just referring to, how you had some Nodites going in and joining up with Van and Amadon. As we'll see here shortly, the Western group, right, that Syrian group, are going to be right there where the garden's going to be. The other ones are, in the in Mesopotamia, and then Elam, is just immediately to the east of Mesopotamia, across the line into what's now Iran, from Iraq. So just immediately to the east of the Tigris. And that whole bit about, since I mentioned it, the central group remained in the immediate vicinity of their original home near the headquarters of the Persian Gulf, right? And that tails on down all the way to the beginning of recorded history with these Sumerians that seem to come out of nowhere, right, in southern Mesopotamia. Right, that group stayed there through all the vicissitudes of all that time. And we're there at the beginning of recorded history. All this mysterious, technology and stuff that, no one can figure out where it came from. Right. Architecture and government and all kinds of stuff, right? Yep.
These Nodites had freely mated with the Sangic races and had left behind an able progeny. And some of the descendants of the rebellious Dalmatians subsequently joined Van and his loyal followers in the lands north of Mesopotamia. Here, in the vicinity of Lake Van and the southern Caspian Sea region, the Nodites mingled and mixed with the Amadonites, and they were numbered among the mighty men of old.
See, so like I said, there's that other group that goes up there. And the quote-unquote mighty men of old, I think everyone knows, that they're doing a quote-unquote from the Bible. We're going to begin, them pointing out the handful of things in those ancient stories in the beginning of Genesis that amazingly, right, didn't get lost in the midst of thousands of years of oral tradition. I mean, just how mind-boggling that is. It reminds you of just how definitive an impact Adam and Eve had on the human mind, that we managed, with all of our desire to spin tales and elaborate, tell fish stories, or the telephone game around the, around the classroom or whatever, we actually held on to some things and details of the garden and then also the fact that way back when there were these higher quality genetic individuals, the mighty men of old, right? Not only the Nodites, but the Adamites, produced these people that everyone, sung of in lore, right? These people that just were wiser and more insightful and were very difficult to overcome in battle they're just telling you that's where that, that isn't just giant stories, right? There literally were mighty men of old. They might even have been even a little taller too, right? But but the key thing that made them mighty is their minds. They had higher quality minds than anyone else. Okay.
Prior to the arrival of Adam and Eve, these groups, Nodites and Amadonites, were the most advanced and cultured races on Earth.
Yeah, like I was just saying. Right. And so obviously, why did they say that? Wasn't that kind of obvious from what we'd already read? Why did they throw in that little sort of footnote, single sentence paragraph? So therefore, it's obvious why Adam and Eve come here. Right, they're not going to pick the depths of genetic quality off in the hinterland somewhere. Right, they're going to be coming to the core. I mean, why are Van and Amadon, still there? Because they're still at the genetic core. Because they're involved in fostering that genetic core, if you will. So, Right, it all, you know, so that just reminds you of how, you know, one would assume that it's quite common that the Adam and Eve's headquarters on any world is going to be not too far from the planetary headquarters, you know, the planetary princess headquarters. Just because it, you know, they need to work closely together. And so, you know, being on opposite sides of a globe would complicate that. They're not magic beings. Okay. All right, what else do we have here?
Section 2, Planning for the Garden. For almost 100 years prior to Tabamanchia's inspection, Van and his associates from their Highland headquarters of World Ethics and Culture had been preaching the advent of a promised son of God, a racial uplifter, a teacher of truth, and the worthy successor of the traitorist Caligastia. Though the majority of the world's inhabitants of those days exhibited little or no interest in such a prediction, those who were in immediate contact with Van and Amadon took such teaching seriously and began to plan for the actual reception of the promised son.
You know, we all go, promised son, isn't that Jesus? Remember, see, that's, you know, every descending son is, quote unquote, that promised son. Not just a bestowal son, and not just a creator son doing a bestowal mission. See, there it is again, for almost 100 years prior to Tabamanch's inspection. Right, so you've got, you know, remember the other one, you know, go back and look if you don't remember. It was, where is it? In a little less than 100 years from the time of his inspection, Adam and Eve, a material son and daughter of the local system, arrived in, okay. So there's a little under 100 years on both sides of Tabamancha, you know, so from the time that the life carriers and the Melchizedeks, you know, were measuring this, you know, we'd reached the apex. And I see, obviously, Van and Amadon knew about that. And there it is again. It's like, well, is that like 81 years? Right? That almost 100 years? It seems suspicious, see, that there's a Gerasim century involved in here for some reason. All right. Let's see. Anything else there? Oh, you notice they say a teacher of truth because it's going to be a dispensational revelation of truth. They always want to put that adjective on poor Caligastia. Well, he deserves it. Traitorous Caligastia. And then notice how some things have always been that way. You know, there was little or no interest in Jesus, right? Yeah, well, it'd be different the next time. No, it'd be the same, you know, when the magisterial son comes. There'd be little or no interest initially, right? Most people are very self-absorbed and, you know, and... you know, and think about how many people we have today, you know, that have no internal recognition of the existence of God because they're not functioning in a human enough fashion, right? And they've looked at the God cult that's out there, you know, all of its different flavors, and, you know, properly, you know, judged it to be just a bunch of magic and superstition and whatnot. You know, and so the baby goes out with the bathwater there. And it's like, yeah, okay, the God notion of the God cult is obviously not real, but what about the real God? And like I said, they have no following thought like that. And, you know, as I stress all the time, the book tells you that as a minimal human, you know, sort of consciously instead of just super consciously, but minimally conscious human, there is nothing more trivially obvious than the existence of God. That is trivially self-evident to conscious human thought. Right? And yet we have all these brilliant people, not obvious to them, right? That there's a baby in the bathwater that they throw out when they throw out all the God cults. So, right, I mean, you know, one can only imagine how dismissive these people would be, even in the face of something, you know, for anyone with any insight, it's like, well, how can you reject that? Isn't that obviously not just you know, a sleight of the hand trick or whatever, right? Something's going on there that's out of the ordinary, is it not? You know, again, there's none so blind as those who will not see. You know, you have people that are, you know, not only as they haven't kind of gotten up to any sort of human insight they're conscious of, now they're actively closing themselves off from that part of their mind. Right? They're willfully walling that, you know, apart from them, from their conscious domain in their mind. So, yeah.
Doesn't the Magisterial Son come with some helpers too?
Yeah, he'll come with, he'll come corporeal, because it's the first Magisterial Son, and the 12 Melchizedeks with him will also be corporeal.
And won't be noticed.
There'll be 13 majestic corporeal beings, but... You can't underestimate how pitiful we are, you know. I mean, it would be really, you know, fascinating to observe that and just see how the world responds. I mean, I have to look back in the, you know, the broadcast to check that out. That's going to be very interesting to see how the planet responds to that. You know, and whether or not that would happen before an even more dramatic thing. Hello, my name is Machiavelli Melchizedek. I'm the ruler of this world. You know, and he starts building a physical planetary headquarters, and right, I mean, how is that going to go down? you know, talk about. Well, you know, I'm just going to take control of this chunk of land. Well, says who? Well, eminent domain says. You know, on what authority do you have eminent domain? Right, I mean, it'll be a fascinating time. He ought to just, like, totally lay it down and just plop himself on Jerusalem. Bulldoze the thing and build the planetary headquarters there. Wouldn't that be upsetting? But
might as well go big.
But, you know, I mean, you know that that would, that you can probably suspect that would be too revolutionary, you know. No matter how dramatic of an individual they are, right, they're always evolutional in their engagement, not revolutional. So, you know, but it's just fun to think about, you know. I mean, you know, they could, I mean, you know, the only reason that you have any right to speculate about radical things like that is, I mean, you know, we've totally, you know, thrown everything out the window on this planet in terms of normal. I mean, I mean, who am I to say what wouldn't be too revolutionary?
Why do you think Greenland's melting?
Right. You know, maybe they'll see to it that all the polar ice caps, you know, finish melting. That the glacial age actually comes to an end before they, you know, they show up. You know, we just saw that they were waiting for it to melt to a certain degree before Adam and Eve came in. Yeah. Right, so you can speculate a lot. Right. Yeah, maybe they'll melt the southern polar ice cap and take over Antarctica. Right. So, yeah, you can speculate a lot about this. It's like, well, wouldn't the seas rise a lot? Yeah. Your point is, right? Yeah, you're going to have to move Cape Canaveral. That's just the way it is. So. You know, there's lots of fun speculation about, you know, about those things. Anyway, let's see, back to this. Little or no interest in such a prediction. You know, and again, remember who's making this prediction. Everyone knows that Van and Amidon have been, you know, alive, you know, by themselves for 150,000 years. Not to mention the 300,000 years before that.
I can only count to three.
You know, I mean, it's like, if this immortal being tells you something, would you not go, okay? Like, oh, whatever. See, again, they can be so matter of fact about immortal beings. Right? So, yeah, anyway. Keep going here.
Van told his nearest associates the story of the material suns on Gerasim, what he had known of them before ever he came to Urantia. He well knew that these Adamic suns always lived in simple but charming garden homes, and proposed, 83 years before the arrival of Adam and Eve, that they devote themselves to the proclamation of their advent and to the preparation of a garden home for their reception.
Okay, now it's becoming even more suspicious. 83 years? You know, see, it's pretty hard not to assume that we're talking about 81, right, with, you know, maybe 5 years, you know, for a travel time and stuff like that. But, yeah, it looks like somehow this is synchronized to a Gerasim century. I mean, who knows why? Let's see, anything else there? You know, wouldn't that be interesting to, what all did he tell them? You know, and, you know, obviously we don't have anything very definitive in terms of a written record about, you know, what he said, but what kind of things fed into mythology, you know, from that? Yeah, so it's just, all, you know, you're just, you know, see, we're getting into the time now that basically everything that happens becomes a seed in a mythology that stems from it, you know, up to today. You know, Adam and Eve become, you know, the model for Osiris and Isis, you know, or, you know, what have you. I mean, everything that's happening here, even if they don't give you any details, there's bound to be something in our stories, right, that stems from it. Because this is you know, recent enough that, you know, a lot is going to be remembered. Yeah. Like I said, you can go to Genesis chapters 2 and 3 and go, oh, yeah, that's what that's referring to there, what they're about to tell us here, you know. We held on to tidbits. So, you know, the stuff before Adam and Eve, you know, the farther you go back, the more, you know, there really isn't much that comes forward into our mythology. It was just, you know, too primitive and too long ago. And but Adam and Eve forward, very much so. Okay.
From their highland headquarters and from 61 far-scattered settlements, Van and Amadon recruited a corps of over 3,000 willing and enthusiastic workers who, in solemn assembly, dedicated themselves to this mission of preparing for the promised, at least expected, son.
It's like, okay, well, I'll expect that. Maybe I won't go with him. But the other thing there is, okay, it's not just the one headquarters. They've got 61 satellite headquarters. See, they mentioned that before. They were working, you know, on trying to do the best they could in setting up regional headquarters and things like they were supposed to from the beginning. We don't know how many of those may have held together to some degree, were set up in the first 300,000 years, and, you know, they were keeping them going forward. I mean, I don't know. But nonetheless, there was a bit of a network in that region anyway that they could draw upon, you know, and that, see, would be a reasonable starting point for Adam and Eve. It's like, don't despair, Adam and Eve. You know, there's a little bit of a network here. You can slowly work. You know, it's not like there's just this one little island amongst a sea of black, right? I mean, but Adam and Eve, you know, we all know they couldn't hold it together. It was just too atypical, too, you know, they were too alone, you know, they were just too overwhelmed by the scope of the project. You know, it's like not just a 25, you know, thousand year project. You know, they had to kind of try to somehow do what the prince and his staff were supposed to be doing for, you know, all that time.
I'm kind of curious. This is all happening while there are Sangic races.
Yeah.
But this is primarily an effort of the Amadonites. There must be something, even though they weren't as maybe sharp intellectually, there seems to be a balance and an ability to stay, you know, I'm trying to think of the word, stability, integrity, mm-hmm, to their nature, that allows them to function in this long-term, steady, flow.
Right, it's two things. You know, you've heard me mention it a number of times, you know, thinking about the Andonites, you know, and hence the Amidonites also, as a pre-blended race, right? You know, there's an effective blending and hence balance and stability of all six sanghics kind of, you know, inherently within them. But also, you know, I mean, the sanghics have been blending into this crew for a long time. So, you know, you have a genetic blend here. I mean, you know, they just, you know, they're just pointing out that you have a dominance of Andonite nature, you know, or even a dominance of the kind of nature that Nod and his fellows had in the Nodites, even if there's, you know, a bunch of Sanghic blended into the Nodites. Yeah, they're not pure in any way. You know, there's been like you're recognizing thousands and thousands and thousands of years of blending, you know, with the Sanghic peoples going on. I mean, didn't we just mention that somewhere? Yeah, these Nodites had freely mated with the Sanghic races, right? Freely mated. Right? So, but it's you know, it reminds you of Adam and Eve don't come to displace the evolutionary peoples with a new pure race, right? They come to just give a dominance of genetic nature to the pre-exist, you know, into the pre-existent people, right? I mean, in the same way that mind dominates matter, right? They're trying to establish kind of the apex of a biologic nature that can dominate the lower biologic nature, right? And the mind that's predicated, you know, that's seated on that, right? There's to give a natural apex of mind that can better dominate the lower domains of mind. You know, I mean, the seventh adjutant is being fundamentally fostered with the Adamic uplift, and the seventh adjutant is the peak of the adjutant structure. So. It's, you know, they don't give us a lot of clues about, you know, exactly what the layout is of, you know, is there not far off kind of a relatively pure group of blue men or, you know, I mean, remember, you can go back and get a little sense of that from what they told you about the migration of the Sanghic races, but, you know, you don't know any of the details, you know, I mean, exactly what it looks like in micro regional character, like in the immediate Near East region, say. You know, I don't know.
Time lapse.
Right. I mean, but even if you don't have to think about them in that immediate region interacting with sort of pure line different groups, there's a bit of a melting pot. Right, to this region. So all the races are kind of effectively involved in what's going on. Okay.
Van divided his volunteers into 100 companies with a captain over each and an associate who served on his personal staff as a liaison officer, keeping Amidon as his own associate. These commissions all began in earnest their preliminary work, and the committee on location for the garden sallied forth in search of the ideal spot.
It's one of my favorite lines where they do sallied forth. In other words, they raced out, right, because they're under, you know, Van is cracking the whip. You know, it's like, okay, we got to get moving here. We got a lot of work to do. I want you to race out. I want you to find some spots and get back here as quick as you can. You know, I mean, he doesn't know how soon it is. That it's sort of kind of just one cycle here of, you know, roughly the 81 years thing. That, you know, maybe he's thinking, well, it might be two cycles, three cycles, I don't know. But, you know, he probably knows, well, what if it's only one cycle? You know, I mean, we've got a lot of work to do, and we only have a few years here. So,
did they ride the horses at that time? Because sallied forth is often.
The sallied forth, you know, I've often wondered, I mean, I don't know. I mean, what about the Fandors, you know? Are they utilizing the Fandors? I don't know. but in some way or another, off they go. What was that?
Frequent
Vandoor
miles.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, you know, you guys all know, they don't go that far, right? I mean, it's just right there in the Fertile Crescent region, you know, and you can get around by camel, you know, in pretty quick fashion, just around the Fertile Crescent region, you know. So, all right, let's see. Anything else there? Again, you see how Van is very much trying to kind of keep the spirit of the organization of the prince's staff going. You know, he breaks everything up into these official committees and delegates, you know, to the different committees, all the different parts of the project, you know.
There's something doubly impressive, too, because we have to remember Van is, what is he? He's a citizen of Jerusalem. So he's essentially immortal himself who's now tasked with...
right. See, you know, he's got a big job that, you know, I mean, he's just a Jerusalem-level mortal, and he's got all of these responsibilities that are in his hands,
No thought adjuster.
Right. You know, don't forget that. Van and Amadon does, but Van doesn't have a thought adjuster. Okay, let's see. He's got all these different ones, because, I mean, someone's got to work on, okay, what's the building design going to be? What's the home design going to be? What's what crops are we going to have there? You know, someone's got to be in charge of, you know, bringing in different kinds of plants and, you know, and animals that they're going to need. And, you know, it's all this logistics. Who's going to design the wall? All that stuff.
Does he have communication with the staff? Do they ever mention that? Is Van in direct communication?
Oh, yeah. Van can see the Melchizedeks and everyone. There. Yeah, he's in. You know, and, you know, we'll get to this in a second here. Right, and the thing you always have to, you know, try to imagine how this is being managed. You got Caligastia or Daligastia, both of them, right in his face, you know. Like, try to focus. You know, they're trying to mess things up. I mean, right? You know, so all they have to do is just sit there and you know, hum some obnoxious tune, you know, while he's trying to think. I mean, how are they managing that? You know, and of course, it's not just Caligastia and Daligastia. There's all the other rebels, you know, all the rebel primary midwayers. And I mean, they got this menagerie of people trying to gum up the works constantly. Yeah. Okay.
Although Caligastia and Daligastia had been deprived of much of their power for evil, they did everything possible to frustrate and hamper the work of preparing the garden. But their evil machinations were largely offset by the faithful activities of the almost 10,000 loyal midway creatures who so tirelessly labored to advance the enterprise.
I was just referring to, and you know, remember, you had 50,000 primary midwayers, but you know, a little over 40,000 joined the rebellion. But you know, you're just left. They just give you a sense. So, okay, give me some specifics. I mean, what are we talking about here? I mean, are the primary midwayers that are loyal, you know, like intercepting, you know, Caligastia, you know, and punching him in the face as he's trying to get, I mean, what exactly are they doing here? How does this work?
What's he doing to frustrate?
Yeah, how, you know, what's he doing to frustrate? I mean, you know, he obviously doesn't have, you know, the original nod and whatnot, right? I mean, we're way down the road from that. But he does have the rebel primary midwayers, and it's not as easy for them to engage the physical as a secondary midwayer, but they can, to some degree, that they never really explain. So, I mean, he could literally be, you know, there could be efforts to literally gum up the works with those rebel primaries. I don't know. It'd be wonderful if they would just give you a couple hints about some of this dynamics.
Were the rebel seraphim still on the planet?
Yeah, all the rebel, including the rebel, you know, unrevealed, you know, angels. And those can definitely engage material things. Mm-hmm. I mean, what does this, you know, this sort of trying to shield from all of that. How, what does that look like?
War of heaven. That looks scary.
I mean, how is this handled? I don't know. Do the master physical controllers help out some? I don't know. You know, not to mention, you know, can any of these spirit controllers do anything? I don't know. But there's so many times when they, you know, like remember we were thinking about what was going on Gerasim and the satellites, the same issue. It's like, well, you know, how literally should we think of this, right? I mean, are there Marantia swords clashing? Or, you know, how do you think about it? I don't know.
It'll be interesting to look it up.
Yeah, you know, like how did the loyal primary midwayers protect the Tree of Life? So, you know, remember, we've thought about all these things before. It's the same questions. Exactly. What am I supposed to visualize here? You know. All right, anyway, so yeah, we're just reminded all of that is in play again, too. All right. What about this, what did they call it? The Committee on Location for the Garden. What did they sally forth and discover?
Three. The garden site. The Committee on Location was absent for almost 3 years. It reported favorably concerning three possible locations. The first was an island in the Persian Gulf, the second, the river location subsequently occupied as the second garden, the third, a long narrow peninsula, almost an island, projecting westward from the eastern shores of the Mediterranean Sea.
Okay, so, like I was saying, it's all just the Fertile Crescent Sea. So they're just doing the usual thing that everyone in the immediate Near East is doing, is going back and forth on that arc of the Fertile Crescent.
It's funny, two of them don't even exist today.
Yeah, and you know, you've got all the issues with not only tectonic activity but sea level changes involved in something like, you know, probably like that island there in the Persian Gulf. They found that location, you know, just south of where the Tigris and the Euphrates come close to each other, you know, in the same neck of the woods there's where Baghdad is, only on the south side of the pinch there, you know, where Babylon was. You can think about, you know, what they're trying to do here, you know, with the second garden, you know, where they end up over there, you know, they're just trying to have kind of a relative separation. I mean, here for this garden, they want something that they can really kind of have they can set up a solid separation from the benighted hordes, you know, in a relatively straightforward way. And, however, you know, the whole bit about, well, you know, how long would that island be around in geologic time? Well, you know, we'll eventually get to that. I mean, when we discover, you know, even the one they picked, they knew was not a very long-term location. That plate tectonics would overwhelm that site in relatively short order, you know, and we weren't, so, you know, they knew that it wasn't, we were not supposed to have a Garden of Eden for an extended period of time on this planet. That was a part of the original plan, is for that to just be a temporary, you know, sort of very centralized phenomenon. And then in very short order, Adam and Eve would have, you know, set up regional headquarters and they would have been, you know, more roaming around between them and stuff, and it wouldn't be so centralized as on a normal world. So, you know, we don't know exactly, you know, what all went into their decision making, but yeah, we all know, as I was about to say, they picked the third option.
The committee almost unanimously favored the third selection. This site was chosen, and 2 years were occupied in transferring the world's cultural headquarters, including the Tree of Life, to this Mediterranean peninsula. All but a single group of the peninsula dwellers peaceably vacated when Van and his company arrived.
Okay, so two fun parts of that. The whole moving project. Right, you've got 150,000 years of stuff built up Think how much you built it up in just your few years on this planet. Yeah, they got all that crap down to the peninsula here, including the Tree of Life. And remember, this is, they're going through hostile territory. And they got to protect this whole caravan. And as they mentioned, when they get there, most of them, oh, we're out of here, yep, no problem. But there was one group that had to be eliminated. Right. So that reminds you of, yeah, we're not talking about some airy, fairy, idealistic thing. You know, the Van and Amidon and their crew went in there and lobbed all their heads off, and that was the end of the group that wouldn't vacate the garden. Yeah, between the lines, what does it say? All but a single group of the peninsula dwellers peaceably vacated. So
perhaps they drove them out. Perhaps they just chased them out.
Right. You confront them physically. You kill enough of them, and then, you know, maybe some of them. Okay, we give up. We'll leave.
I thought they just got to stay there and live aside.
No.
In a little,
no.
Little right. Village.
I see that. You know, we're about to see. The whole point is, no. We purify the place of anything that's there. You know, we set up shop and we built a very big wall and stuff that, you know, to keep all the riffraff out. You know.
That's where that idea came from.
Yeah, we've mentioned it before. Remember, what was step one with the planetary headquarters? Build a wall, right? step one here, build a wall. All right. You have to physically, you know, separate yourself. You know, if people won't, you know, of their own free will, keep themselves in their place, right? The nation is a people of a place, right? I mean, if they won't choose to be in that place of that people of that place, then you're going to have to, you know, put a wall between you and them. You know, no, this is our place. That's your place. Nations are a people of a place. Nations aren't, you know, nomadic. You know, that's tribes. A nation is not nomadic. It has a given place. Because right, there's no way that you can go from nation to state, territorial state, place is still there, remember? You know, you have to have citizens, not just people of a place, right? You have to have citizens to have statehood. Right? So, you know, you've got to have that definitive separation, or the citizenship is not definable. Right? And statehood is not not possible. Let's see. I forgot where we were. Oh, yeah, the third section. Yeah, vacated. Okay, yep, keep going.
This Mediterranean peninsula had a salubrious climate and an equable temperature. This stabilized weather was due to the encircling mountains and to the fact that this area was virtually an island in an inland sea. While it rained copiously on the surrounding highlands, it seldom rained in Eden proper. But each night, from the extensive network of artificial irrigation channels, a mist would go up to refresh the vegetation of the garden.
Now, let me just speak to the quote-unquote there. Again, obviously that's a little snippet, you know, amongst other stuff there in Genesis, where, you know, they're saying, yeah, you know that line there? Okay, set aside the, you know, how it's rationalized into the, you know, the rest of the passage there, but see, that's coming literally from something that's being remembered. You know, remember, that wasn't written down until the 6th century B.C., right? And the actual mist would go up 400,000 years ago. They held on to that little tidbit and got it into the story that's in the book of Genesis.
Well, how many years ago? 40,000. Did you say
400? I don't know. I should have said 40 if I didn't. I meant 40,000 if I didn't say it.
It's funny because it's kind of like our architectural worlds are water, too. It's a mist that goes.
Yeah.
Interesting thing.
Yeah, yeah. See, so they're playing off of that, you know, that kind, that, because, you know, they're starting to, even more so than the planetary headquarters, trying to bring the pattern of Gerasim down to the to a given planet. You know, so that it's as above, so below eventually. Yeah, so very much that you know, the patterns that are up there, very, you know, very proper for you to recognize that. Now, the one thing here that you can easily get confused about, you can't sort of really recognize your confusion until you continue on here into the next paragraph. But they're talking about two different surrounding or encircling here. Okay, so, you know, picture the eastern end of the Mediterranean. Okay, you know, so you've got, yeah, you guys, if I wrap it around to your side, you know, your Mediterranean comes to that rounded, you know, rectangle end there on its eastern end. And, you know, so to the north and east, you know, on the shore of the Mediterranean, you have the quote-unquote encircling mountains. Okay, but then if you focus in on this little peninsula, right, almost island that's not there anymore, that's coming off, you know, what's now Syria, coming off that eastern shore. You know, you've got a thin little neck, and then you've got a little bulb part that, you know, that's kind of like the island out in the Mediterranean. That area has the surrounding highlands, right? The coast of that almost island is high, and there's kind of an inner depression, you know, so water flows down into that kind of bowl shape and down the neck of the peninsula and, you know, off towards the Euphrates, okay? So there's two different surrounding things there. A lot of people I've noticed over the years get confused and think those are talking about the same thing there, but it's two separate. Now, one is just called Highland Sea and the other is called Mountains. Because, and remember, is a very geologically active region. You know, I mean, not only is there just plate tectonics in general, but you have all kinds of complicated plate boundaries and little plates. And it's a very complicated region right in there. And that's why, you know, they all would have known that nothing lasts for any length of time, right? I mean, you'd be lucky to even find any trace of this big river that used to flow out through Syria towards, you know, you'd have to dig and look for some residual terrace gravels or something, you know, but the, you know, the mountains are all different sizes and heights, and, you know, everything has changed radically in the last 40,000 years there. Yeah. All right.
The coastline of this landmass was considerably elevated, and the neck connecting with the mainland was only 27 miles wide at the narrowest point. The great river that watered the garden came down from the higher lands of the peninsula and flowed east through the peninsular neck to the mainland and thence across the lowlands of Mesopotamia to the sea beyond. It was fed by four tributaries which took origin in the coastal hills of the Edenic Peninsula, and these are the four heads of the river which went out from Eden, and which later became confused with the branches of the river surrounding the second garden.
I think anyone who's ever, you know, studied humans trying to figure out where the garden was based upon what's in the Bible. You know, there's been endless guys who've gone on lifelong efforts to try to sleuth this out. Right? You know, they try to rationalize everything, you know, relative to the to Mesopotamia. And but this, it's basically because the story in the Bible, yeah, it's not only very ancient, so it's, you know, not going to be very precise, but it has the first garden and the second garden muddled together, okay? And, you know, even the fact that they had to put four heads in one quote and out of Eden in another quote shows you they're taking a couple chunks and saying, well, okay, the way you've stuck those chunks together in Genesis is not proper, but, you know, but the two chunks actually have an origin in fact. See, so what you actually have, and there you can see the coastline of this landmass was considerably elevated. See, that's the surrounding highlands, right? The ring around the, kind of the bowl in the middle of Eden proper. And you have four rivers coming down those highlands, down into that bowl and, you know, coming together in a stream that heads out the peninsula. And like I said, you know, doesn't have to go very far until it hits the Euphrates, you know, and then heads down to the Persian Gulf.
Okay. You can see why they picked it. It sounds like a beautiful spot.
Yeah. It's really cool. I mean, just, you know, just you can picture yourself there, you know, almost in a cirque-like valley, you know, if you will. You know, these surrounding highlands, it would be very beautiful. You know, and, you know, as they pointed out there, you have all this this rain, you know. So, you know, everything would be very green. And let's see here. What else do we have there? We'll see it later on, and they actually do some quotes. There's, you know, the fact that you can see kind of the whole orientation of this space is eastward, right? You know, the river, you know, is flowing eastward, you know, the entryway is on the east of all this. You know, that's why in Genesis you know the direction that you see coming up, you know, they speak of east in there, right? And you'll see even one more specific detail when they actually bring that up. But you know, you see it right here, flowed east. That if you're familiar with the story, you go, oh, I wonder if that has something to do with the eastward appearing in the Genesis story. Let's see here. Anything else? No, I think, yeah, we've got everything here. Yeah, keep going.
The mountains surrounding the garden abounded in precious stones and metals, though these received very little attention. The dominant idea was to be the glorification of horticulture and the exaltation of agriculture.
So they didn't immediately set up all kinds of mines with mine waste flowing down the tributaries. And, right, okay. But see, again, that reminds you of just how tectonically active this region is. The fact that it would be that abounded in precious stones and metals. You can see, again, they're reminding you that, you know, one of the deals about why you always have a garden, I'll talk about that a little bit more in a second, but as Adam and Eve are involved in, you know, even more so in trying to push things from hunter, herder to farmer, you know, whether it be gardens or orchards or, you know, actual fields of grain, farmer. So they're working on that, pushing things forward in the developmental epochs, and that whole evolution that we talked about. All right. Let's see. I guess that was all there. Yep. Keep going.
The site chosen for the garden was probably the most beautiful spot of its kind in all the world, and the climate was then ideal. Nowhere else was there a location which could have lent itself so perfectly to becoming such a paradise of botanic expression. In this rendezvous, the cream of the civilization of Urantia was foregathering. Without and beyond, the world lay in darkness, ignorance, and savagery. Eden was the one bright spot on Urantia. It was naturally a dream of loveliness, and it soon became a poem of exquisite and perfected landscape glory.
Ooh, how about that little poetic flourish? you see it right there. Coincidentally, you know, right in this, the neck of the woods where Van and Amidon are, you know, is nowhere else was there a location which could, you know, so not in North America, South America, right? Africa, anywhere else. They didn't have to go far, coincidentally. In supremacy, there are no coincidences. And they mentioned the climate was then ideal. See, again, that whole synchronizing, you're right there when the ice age is coming to an end. So at least, you know, that far south in the northern hemisphere, you have just a, you know, very favorable climate. Let's see.
It still is today when you go out there.
Yeah. In many ways, you know, you've got the whole Mediterranean climate, right? I mean, you know, the, the moderation of things by that big body of water. You know, like they mentioned, it's basically an island and an inland sea. And so between the mountains and the water, you know, moderating the climate, and, yeah, everything is just wonderful. Let's see. And again, you see, without and beyond, the world lay in darkness, ignorance, and savagery. You know, that kind of reminds me of an island on the neighboring planet, see? so you can see, you know, why it's highly likely that the garden was on that island on the neighboring planet, too, you know? As we talked about, you could be very suspicious of that anyway. And, you know, they needed to make this definitive, that stuff was without, right? And that's not going to just happen naturally. You need to build a wall, right? You know, there's just no other way. You know, you're not just going to have a conversation with the savages and they'll all respect your wonderful little place. I mean, the more it becomes this poem of exquisite and perfected landscape glory, you think envy is going to increase? Yeah. If not other people wanting that, they want to just destroy it, you know, because, you know, it's in their face as an affront to their civilization, right? How dare you, you know, make it look like, you know, you're better people. I mean, that's the other continents on the neighboring planet. So you're thinking the same way about the island continent, right? It's just, you know, there's this hatred for that, you know, what appears to be a statement of a higher quality, right? People don't like that, even if it's a fact. All right, let's see. We probably have time to get a little bit more here.
Four, establishing the garden. When material sons, the biologic uplifters, begin their sojourn on an evolutionary world, their place of abode is often called the Garden of Eden because it is characterized by the floral beauty and the botanic grandeur of Edentia, the constellation capital. Van well knew of these customs and accordingly provided that entire peninsula be given over to the garden. Pasturage and animal husbandry were projected for the adjoining mainland. Of animal life, only the birds and the various domesticated species were to be found in the park. Van's instructions were that Eden was to be a garden, and only a garden. No animals were ever slaughtered within its precincts. All flesh eaten by the garden workers throughout all the years of construction was brought in from the herds maintained under guard on the mainland.
So, let's see. If the peoples that they were on the peninsula when they got there were in the darkness, ignorance, and savagery, would they, any of them be allowed to stay there? They won't even let animals, right, be there. They won't even let animals be slaughtered there. Right? That, it's that degree of idyllic space that they're wanting to establish there. Right? I mean, you know, it borders on, you know, the way we think in terms of you know, kind of religious purity sorts of things. You know, but they, you know, that's the natural estate. That, you know, they're trying to appeal to that purity sensibility to foster a beginning recognition of unity, right? Even if it is material and not spiritual, right? But, you know, there's a place for that material idealism in a, you know, in a primitive people to try to foster genuine spiritual idealism recognition. But we're way past that, right? As we've talked about all the time, right? Now, that material idealism is the very reason there's an emergency on the planet. Okay.
So they wouldn't even slaughter animals. They may not have taken the route of slaughtering the people who wouldn't leave voluntarily.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, but you know, everyone knows what a what a physical confrontation involves. I mean, there's going to be at least some a couple examples of, you know, if 10 people, you know, run through with with swords, you know, everyone says, okay, I think we'll give up here. You know,
well, but, maybe they were just clever with the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, we can always do something. But you know, as we're about to see, they don't treat the other peoples very delicately. You know, we'll see some examples of that. There's a reason why I'm speculating like I am. I'm not just pulling that out of thin air. You know, it's a level of harshness that we have a hard time countenancing, you know, today.
History.
Yeah.
You know, the Romans or the Greeks, they didn't treat the other people very delicately.
No,
it was
no.
It was kind of very common. It wasn't like we look at it today.
Right, the so-called chosen people, right, the Jews, and there was a degree of truth to that in its time. Right, I mean, you know, yeah, they thought it was exactly what they should do, is they kill every man, woman, and child, right? They might have done that, yeah. Yeah, lest their blood pollute the ground, yeah. But anyway, yeah, you get my point. Let's see here. Okay, so back to this. The first thing is that whole bit about, you know, for the Adam and Eve on any world, you know, this statement, it's often called the Garden of Eden because it is characterized by the floral beauty and botanic grandeur of Edentia. Okay. Here's a time for everyone to remember, no one is speaking English on high, right? That headquarters of our constellation is not literally, the people there are called Edentia, right? Right, they're, right, it's called something, and they're telling you that the gardens are often named in parallel. But what they've done is, you know, we call our garden the Garden of Eden. That's how it's come to be called here. So then they just take that word, you know, and use it to give an English name for the constellation headquarters, right? So, you know, the literalness of Edentia is the Edenic place. Okay, well, what does Edenic mean? Eden is a Hebrew word that means delight. Right, the delightful place. Didn't they just describe a delightful place? You know, that's why they just did that little poetic flourish, is to remind you of the literal meaning of the word Eden, so you could properly think about. So the two are connected. It's just that normally it's connected top down. For writing this book, they connected the two bottom up. They took a lower word and used it for the upper. Yeah. So in truth, right, you have the truth of the connection. The fact, right, is a little different because no one is speaking, you know, in a polyglot language of English. You know, here we have Latin stuff. Well, modified by them, you know, the IA suffix being modified to a TIA suffix, you know, and this Hebrew root and all this stuff. I mean, you know, none of that's going on the constellation headquarters. Okay, but anyway, so that's the spirit, if you will, the truth of what's going on there. Let's see. We've already kind of talked about the whole bit of. See that, you know, even long term, you notice that pasturage and animal husbandry were projected for the adjoining mainland. So there's a long term plan to take some relatively definitive control of that immediate on the other side of the walls area too. See, because they're going to be expanding their influence outward, but they start with this little core and build a big wall, and you know. Get things built up there. Can't keep the birds out, so there's birds there. Whatever bird wants to be there, and then they bring in various domesticated species.
Cows and milk and things like this.
Yeah,
animals to help them.
Rocks. Yeah, right. You've got these domesticated species.
More feed than milk.
Yeah, not to mention Fandor's. Let's see. Okay, yeah, we got it all there. Yeah, keep going.
The first task was the building of the brick wall across the neck of the peninsula. This once completed, the real work of landscape beautification and home building could proceed unhindered.
See, I mean, they didn't... See, again, that's a very first step. Because they don't want to waste time on a whole bunch of fancy stuff, only to have the hordes come in, burn it all down. Because they couldn't control them all. So, wall comes first.
Make bricks.
Yeah, and then, make bricks. Yep. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. What was it? 27, wasn't it? Where the heck did it say that? Is that what everyone's remembering? Yeah. There. Yeah. 27 miles wide at the narrowest point. Yeah. Yep.
A zoological garden was created by building a smaller wall just outside the main wall. The intervening space, occupied by all manner of wild beasts, served as an additional defense against hostile attacks. This menagerie was organized in 12 grand divisions, and walled paths led between these groups to the 12 gates of the garden, the river and its adjacent pastures occupying the central area.
Right, so they had all kinds of different carnivores, and they didn't want the carnivores eating the other carnivores, so they've got them turned into a zoo here. And so you got 12 gates through the main wall.
So people could get back.
Right, so people could get back for it. And then, coming out from those gates, you have these walled walkways, or pathways. I'm sure they have to have carts and stuff or whatever. But, so that the lower height wall, would turn in and be parallels along each of those 12 paths. And if you think about it, let's assume that the river is basically in the middle, so you need 12 of the 12 regions pins. You'd have six on each side. So see how that works. You've got if I have six paths, don't I have just five? Right, bins in between. It's like no. Remember, they're just pointing out in the middle. Right, you've got the river. So you've got that, that region there, go home and draw a picture, sort it out for in your head if you can't visualize it. then you get questions like, well, how did they handle the river? I mean, couldn't they people maybe get up the river and go under the wall? Because obviously there's got to be some way where the river's going under the wall, right? So you can imagine they must have had some sort of some sort of, trestle thing or whatever, some sort of barred structure, that the river could flow through. But you wouldn't want it too much, you'd constantly have it getting, clogged up and stuff, but maybe they had to clean it a lot and you wouldn't want it too wide because then people could easily slip through. So, I mean, there's all the management of all that, and they probably had, they probably made sure that if it wasn't there already, they had, large reptiles with teeth in the river. if the walls don't stop you, the carnivores will eat you if you try to attack us, So that's the first sign. They're not squeamish. watching the carnivores eat the attackers. Let's see, and what else do we have there? I think we got everything there. The fact that it says central area there at the end, like I was saying, it sounds like apparently the river was pretty right down the middle of the thing, So, it probably was six on each side.
In the preparation of the garden, only volunteer laborers were employed. No hirelings were ever used. They cultivated the garden and tended their herds for support. Contributions of food were also received from nearby believers, and this great enterprise was carried through to completion in spite of the difficulties attendant upon the confused status of the world during these troublous times.
Yeah, so in other words, they were having to defend the place the whole time they're building the wall. There's an onslaught, one wave after another, trying to take them down. Yeah.
Not to mention those other characters.
You can, yeah.
And that's probably what the prince was doing.
You're right.
He's probably inciting the dumber people to get in there.
Yeah, right. That's obviously one thing that the prince and crew could be up to, yeah. If we don't have that many physical hands, let's, enlist them. See, and again, for that, the prince would have to be using, some of the rebel beings that could, engage humans. You know, if it's not the primary midwayers, it would have to be those lesser angels, right, that are kind of like secondary midwayers that, could interface with the humans and whip them up, Isn't that just disgusting the way they forced you off that, that wonderful place, you went peacefully now, but doesn't that stick in your craw? Don't you want to take up arms and show them who's boss? Right. So, you can just imagine. And don't forget, some of the peoples that are in that region are those northern Nodites, those Syrian Nodites. So we're not talking totally, primitive peoples either. People who can conceive of a sophisticated attack and, weaponry and stuff. So, that's why they say, in spite of the difficulties, and, how many people who volunteered died, right, to make this happen? How many humans died to build the Great Wall of China? Right? How many humans had to die to make this wall happen? Like I was saying, that's 27 mile long wall with all of these, zoo pens and a secondary wall, and oh my goodness gracious, that's a lot of work. All right.
But it was a cause for great disappointment when Van, not knowing how soon the expected son and daughter might come, suggested that the younger generation also be trained in the work of carrying on the enterprise in case their arrival should be delayed. This seemed like an admission of lack of faith on Van's part and made considerable trouble, caused many desertions. But Van went forward with his plan of preparedness, meantime filling the places of the deserters with younger volunteers.
Right, so not only, how did they say it way back there, what was that, how did they describe there wasn't much interest, I can't remember, exhibited little or no interest, in such a prediction? Okay, even the ones that exhibited an interest, right, can be so easily disillusioned. I mean, it's Van, guys. He's been around for hundreds of thousands of years. What do you mean he has little faith? I mean, wow. Obviously he's just full of it. I'm out of here. I mean, it's just amazing when you think about
it. Had to do with faith, or just had to do with?
Well, faith as they saw it, quote unquote faith. Remember what the dictionary says. Faith is, it's credulous belief.
Yeah, I didn't mean that. He was probably trying to be wise. He could, right?
Well, of course he was. He doesn't know, is it, if it's some sort of 100 thing here, is it going to be one cycle or two cycles? He doesn't know. I'm sure no one that he can talk to, the Melchizedeks don't know either. No one knows. the Melchizedeks say, well, they'll get here when they get here.
As much as we do.
Right, that's all above our pay grade about when exactly they come. They're all thinking, Van, wisdom is the opposite of faith. that's what they're thinking. See, you should just believe in the face of, of any logic or wisdom. And as I said, it's they're projecting their notion of faith onto Van.
That's a lot today.
Yeah. But these are, these earnest volunteers. What do we want, Adam and Eve? What do we want them now? See, they've got that thought. You're picking the more spiritually animated individuals like this in this volunteer process. So they're immediately going to be subject to impatience, just like all of us today are with our initial spiritual energizing. And just boom, one generation, and they give up. And that, that feeds forward, when we get to Adam and Eve, that's the amazing thing. How long do they last?
Not long.
Right? They had about the same time scale as this crew. Is that not just amazing? They just immediately got sucked into this easily disillusioned, people all around them, and
you said, they did that almost the first day they were there.
Yeah, as we'll see, it's it actually isn't 100, a little over 100 years. It's like they didn't last a day. They were disillusioned. So it reminds you of, even when you have a lot of genetic quality, and in their case, who knows how many years of living on Gerasim, how many tens of thousands of years of living on Gerasim, you can be very easily pulled down. You need to actively resist, having the things of the world drag you down. Good genetics only goes so far. I mean, you have to have unshakable hold of the integrity of the cosmos. You got to be like Van, like we talked about. I mean, Van's steadiness is not due to his relationship to God the Father. It's due to his relationship to God the Mother. Van and the other nine of his group, right, were the ones that had the greatest innate embodiment of wisdom. Right? It wasn't just something that they could occasionally consciousize. They were just, like I said, it's innate. It's, they just are that solid wisdom. And they're not going to lose their foresight. They're not going to drop down and be impatient. It's again, to Van's credit, right? It wasn't just 200,000 years ago, but every day until he left, he had to stand unmoved, he and Amidon, against just this constant entropy, right, as it were, of everyone around him. He turns their back on him for 5 minutes, and they're building the golden calf, as it were. It's that same thing that Moses was struggling with. It's like, can't you guys hold it together for 5 minutes? just immediately, really? You're off on a tangent?
I have to hog tie them so I can go over here a little bit.
Material gravity just pulls them back to the old ways, in a heartbeat. So we're all like that. We have to, you have to choose every moment to keep your head above, where material gravity is constantly trying to drag you down to. All right.
Their suggestion was cosmic stamina.
Just say one more thing and then we'll wrap it up. That whole bit of, how do I keep from being pulled down? Aren't my feet innately there? No, you need to rotate 180 degrees, and eliminate this, right? Your feet are planted on eternity, right? And they're held there by spirit gravity, right? Okay, they're not going anywhere now. Now, what does material gravity do? It naturally pulls your hands down into time and matter, and you serve, right? Material gravity, facilitates you reaching down and serving. But your feet are no longer subject to material gravity. Your feet are firmly anchored by spirit gravity in the cosmos, right? And then you can't be pulled down anymore. That's why Van and Amidon couldn't be pulled down, because material gravity can't get a hold of their feet. Right? Just think about it literally like that and understand what you want to foster a growth towards. That's what you're trying to end up in, is that state. You know, where you aren't just desperately trying to hold on with your fingernails, you know, that desperate faith grasp up there trying to hold on. You know, you got to eliminate that. Transcend that. No fingernails required when you have your feet planted and what you're trying to reach up to initially with your hands. You know, and hence because you're using your hands for that, there's nothing left for them to serve. Right? You're totally occupied with yourself. You really can't think about anyone else. Right? Till you take your salvation for granted, till your feet are planted on rock, like Jesus said, you never will really serve. You know, there's always going to be that clamoring of self, you know, getting in the way. Well, I can do the job, you know, for a month, but you can't expect me to serve in this position for more than a month. Right? How many times has some spiritually animated person said that? They have all these great ideas because they're all spiritually animated and they start up something, you know. But, you know, I mean, you can't expect me to do this job for more than a month. I mean, have I been doing this study group for more than a month? Yeah. I'll do it till the day I die. All right? Because it's, you know, I've gotten at least that to that degree above myself. Right? I mean, everyone needs to, you know, get at least that much above themselves that they can just, you know, serve others without that pile of clamoring monkeys that's in your head, right? Getting in the way. All right. We'll just keep on. It continues in this mode, giving us these basic details and always looking for the opportunities, like I said, remember that line in Genesis? Yep, that's what it actually came from. You know, it's just fun to not only get an idea of what Adam and Eve are really up to, but just how many times we held on to something, you know, from the real story. Okay, let's take a moment, everyone.